Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to New Books and Folklore, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dan Moran. John O'Connor hails from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and now teaches journalism at Boston College. His writing has appeared in the New York Times, Oxford American, and GQ. He's here today to talk about his new book, The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster, published in 2024 by Source Books. Welcome, John.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
So your book really is not about whether or not Bigfoot exists, right? It's about Bigfooters and their culture and the other kind of issues that get raised by this monster. But anybody listening is going to want to know right at the outset. So let's get this question out of the way. Are you a believer?
So I have a real cop-out answer to that, which is that I don't like to give a direct answer to it just because it's such, as you hinted at, it's such a spoiler for the book. You know, I really want readers to arrive at that themselves. And I think it won't take them very long to discern where my beliefs fall. But that was a real point of debate for me, and something I really struggled with, especially in the early stages of this book, how much to insert my own kind of editorializing and my own opinions. You know, I tried as hard as I could to, for the most part, to withhold those and let the story develop and let readers kind of come to some understanding of where my thoughts were. But I have to say I did a lot of hand wringing in the early stages just about that question, but both from kind of a structural kind of thematic point of view, and also just from a kind of writerly and argumentative would it be, but I didn't want to constantly be in the lens and be constantly getting in the way of readers by inserting my own opinions at, you know, every 10 pages or whatever. So anyway, I know that's kind of a bummer response, but I will just say that, you know, like, I think this is pretty clear by the end of the book, is that I think people have to be governed by reason and rationality as far as it's possible. I mean, it might actually turn out that we're extremely limited in those respects, but we have to try, and Bigfoot unfortunately just doesn't hold up well there.
Yeah, the title, it's funny because somebody not knowing would think that maybe this is a book about, like, I'm gonna actually get the secret history of Bigfoot, but you know, the title's kind of playful, like you are throughout the book.
Yeah. And, you know, to be honest, I didn't have much say in the title. My original title was different from that. And there was a lot of back and forth and hand-wringing with my publisher over the title. It's a little, I want to be careful what I say, but as a few commentators have mentioned, there's nothing particularly secret about, you know, in the book, unless you really consider this a kind of backdoor, you know, bird's eye view at Bigfoot and sort of behind the scenes and into a portrait of Bigfoot's lives, which is really what I wanted to do. Yeah. But besides that, there's not a whole lot here that will be unfamiliar to Bigfooters. And there's also not that much history. You know, I didn't want to do what all books about Bigfoot, especially the many, many, many self-published Bigfooter, you know, any, almost any Bigfooter of any stature has published his or her own book about Bigfoot, and they all recast all the legend and lore and the history of the Skookum cast and all the stuff. And I, well, Patterson Gimlin film. And I didn't want to do that. I just didn't want to retread all that ground again. I mean, I do actually do talk about the Patterson Gimlin film, which I think probably we'll get into later, but you know, I do it in context because I went to Bluff Creek. So there are moments where I have to provide some history and backstory to just to give color and context to what I'm talking about. But I also didn't want it to be straight up history. So there was some of that in there for history buffs, definitely. But it really was, you know, so my original title is Captured. This is more information that you wanted, I realized. But
no, I want to know the title.
Okay. But the original title was Field Note, the working title, all the way up until when I turned the book in, was Field Notes on the North American Sasquatch. And I really wrote it and reported it as that, as a kind of field guide sort of thing, you know, almost in that ornithology field guide flavor of things. And but they wanted Bigfoot in the title, and they apparently, my original title didn't test market that well. They have this, my publisher has a proprietary test marketing thing, and that didn't test well. So they threw this kind of somewhat gimmicky title on it. But I think, you know, to in their defense, they wanted it because they think it'll sell better that way, and that's fine with me. I want to sell books. So my sister-in-law, who's exactly their target audience, was when I told her she's new title, she was like, oh yeah, right, that's it, that's what you want. So she's you know, the people that are hopefully the kind of marginal interest folks who are picking up based on the title.
So yeah, sure, that's why I picked it up, to be fully, I mean, that's why when I first saw it, I'm like, oh, I'd read that. And it was funny because then when I started reading it, I remember saying to someone years ago, I'm like, you know what somebody should write? Somebody should write a book not about whether or not Bigfoot exists. Like, someone should write a book about people who look for Bigfoot, and you went and did it. So kudos to you.
Thank you. Yeah, and that really hadn't been done yet as far, you know, I mean, Bob Pyle did it in his book, Where Bigfoot Walks, but that takes place. He's not a journalist. That's not a knock against him, but he's more of a prose writer and poet, and he takes a very myopic view at Bigfoot in a specific area, Pacific Northwest, Mount St. Helens. And John Zada did it with his book, but that's also, he is a journalist, but that's in British Columbia. And nobody had really done the journalistic kind of outsider perspective at Bigfoot in the United States, and also with this kind of geographical dispersal that I have, looking at it from kind of trying to at least take it in from all four points of compass.
Right. So we're not going to talk about Bigfoot's existence, but I want to read a quotation from your book and get your reaction to it. Okay. You say this about a third of the way through the book. You say, quote, Bigfoot may or may not be real, but either way, there's something profoundly true about the feelings it evinces. So talk about that.
Yeah, like, you know, I mean, one of the things I encountered a lot, I mean, I spoke to, I think I interviewed probably upwards of 100 Bigfooters for this book. Not all of them, unfortunately, could make it into the book. But, you know, on expeditions and at conferences and festivals, I talked to a lot of people, and many, 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 many of them will come up to you and tell you their firsthand account of a Bigfoot sighting. And you know, those are really hard to discount, you know, and I certainly didn't want at any point to wag my finger at them and tell them that they were wrong about what they saw, or you know, God forbid, like, you know, imply that they're being dishonest or just disingenuous or stupid or anything. I don't think that about big tourism, certainly not my subjects. And so, you know, I had this experience over and over again when people tell you, like, well, let me regale you with this. You know, I was crossing the, you know, driving on the road one night, and something crossed in front of me, and I had really good luck ahead. It wasn't a deer, it wasn't a bear, it wasn't a moose, and there's nothing else that explains it. And that was something that I found really, you know, almost moving in a way. Like, and there were, I didn't meet a lot of people, and some of them are in my book. Those experiences really profoundly affected and even changed the course of their lives. And I wanted to be respectful of that. So while I have my own thoughts about what might be happening there, I didn't want it to intrude on their experiences.
Yeah. So your aim in the book was therefore to kind of give a portrait of these folks, which you do as you kind of travel around the country, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So I want to get your reaction. I got one from a quotation, but I want to get your reaction to one of the epigraphs you have at the start. And I thought this one really summarized the book as a whole. This is by Daniel C. Taylor, who I learned from you and reading things, did all this work about the Yeti and the Himalayas. And he said this, and I want to get your reaction to this quotation and why you chose it to preface the book. He says, quote, "The search is not for a wild man, but for how wildness has left men, then to bring that wildness back."
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's such a powerful saying. I mean, I think this, you know, big tension in the book, and I'm claiming Bigfooting, it's this, you know, the kind of war we have in our into modern domesticity with nature, with American ecology in general, you know, the distance we travel, but especially, you know, really you could argue, I guess, it's the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, but in a really accelerated way in the last 5 or 10 years. You know, we really now, we've just lost our ability to navigate for ourselves, quite literally. We have to have someone, I'm not excluding myself from this, you know, we have to have something telling us whether to turn left or right, you know, and we've just become even more profoundly alienated from our natural environment than ever before. And I think that really is wearing on us in some pretty telling ways at Bigfoot up at play, because is one manifestation of that. And also just our sadness, our sort of cultural wide grief over the wanton despoiling of our natural landscapes. I mean, this country has just been completely destroyed by, you know, the wrecking ball of progress.
Yeah.
I think there's real grief and real understanding now in this sort of climate change era among sort of in every corner of the country, people in every corner of the world, people know what's happening. I think for the most part, you have some deniers, but you know, and I think that Bigfoot is tapping into something, some grief and some heartache over what's been lost.
Yeah, you say the Bigfoot phenomenon is these are your words. You say it's a reckoning with our estrangement from nature. Right, which is funny because you have to go. It's about these people that go out into nature and out into the woods because they've lost something, you know, in their day to day existence, or that the woods, they're trying to get back this meaning. It seemed to me of the forest and what that meant. It's almost like a medieval sense of what the forest used to mean. And how do you do that if you're in Oklahoma?
Yeah. Although Oklahoma has a huge Bigfooting.
Yeah,
I was just in Tulsa and. So and there's a lot happening there. There is in Texas and all over the country, and that's what one of the really kind of fascinating things about Bigfooting. It's no longer, you know, as you I'm sure you know, like confined to the Pacific Northwest or the traditional environments of Bigfoot. It's that he's popping up in, you know, in the Tampa suburbs or you know, half an hour from Columbus, Ohio, which is nearly a million people. You know, but yeah, you know, Bigfoot is, I think, part of this. What folks call a sort of rewilding project, you know, just trying to get in touch with some other version of ourselves that's not quite so masculated or just alienated from competency wild. You know, again, I'm including myself in that. And I think some of the thrill of Bigfooting is that moment of finding yourself in danger, or seemingly in danger or in peril, which not many people do these days, you know, and that of course, that's the thrill of the chase, the thrill of the wild. It's a huge part of the project.
Yeah, some of the humor scenes in the book are when you're in your tent, like trying to like make stuff work, and then you hear people yelling, and someone has a sighting, and so it's kind of funny that like you do not look at the Bigfooters from a mountaintop. You're right there with them. And that's yeah. Clearly like you knew that from day one, I imagine, when you started this project. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, as I say in the first chapter, like half the reason for doing it originally was to just after COVID to get to travel around this great country of ours and see the landscapes, a lot of them, which I hadn't seen. And that shamefully had never been to the Pacific Northwest, never saw the, you know, Mount St. Helens, never saw the Cascades or any of that stuff. And never been to, I've been to Texas, but never been to particular parts of Texas. I visited, never been to Central Kentucky. And I just wanted to be out there, as I'm sure a lot of folks did. And I also just wanted to meet people. And
Did it make more sense to you when you went to the Pacific Northwest for the first time? There's that part where you talk about Mount St. Helens. Did it make more sense to you when you went there that you're like, okay, yeah, I get it. Like, it makes perfect sense why people would think there's a Bigfoot around here.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's where, I mean, it's kind of complicated, but more or less, that's essentially where the modern iteration of Bigfoot begins. Mid-century America comes out of Northern California and Washington and Oregon for the better part of a half a decade was more or less confined to that area. Yeah, and the wilderness there is just intense. I mean, it's just like nothing like what we have out east. Nothing against the east here where I live, but it's wonderful in its own way. But the landscapes there are just so mind-boggling. It just boggles the imagination, and I mean that literally and sort of figuratively. Like that's, I think there's room for a lot there to happen.
Yeah, I remember one day, I don't know why this stuck in my mind so much, but one thrilling detail in the beginning was you talk about how mind-bogglingly vast everything is. There's a description of somebody watching Mount St. Helens erupt and how fast the lava goes. And I was thinking of, bad sci-fi movies when I was a kid about what volcanoes look like. And you make the point that like, no, that thing, that lava's at you in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was instantaneous. That's a great, by the way. That section is... realize the fact that I, just had no knowledge of that area and was so enthralled with the history and the legend and lore. And Bigfoot plays in the Mount St. Helens in a pretty major way, even into the eruption. It's an amazing landscape.
Another thing I had no idea about, connected to Mount St. Helens was the whole story about Peter Matheson, who's this revered author of The Snow Leopard, which everyone has read or tried to read at some point, that he was very, very interested in Bigfoot. So can you tell our listeners about that?
Yeah, Peter worked. And that was really an origin point for this book, too, is that it kind of began as an art. Well, there were a couple of origin points, but I don't want to belabor them too much. But it sort of began as a screenplay. But then what ultimately became this book grew out of what I imagined was going to be an article, like a long article about Peter Matheson, who I'd written about before as a writer that I really admired. We passed away 2000. Embarrassed not to say I can't remember 2011. But he, no, more recently than that. Anyway, you can read or listen to fact check that for me. But anyway, he was, very serious guy, National Book Award winner, just a very sane, sober, intellectual guy. And I found out in a roundabout way that he was also a Bigfooter and worked on this Bigfoot novel for the better part of 2 decades, which he never finished. It was found on his desk. After he died, he also worked on some nonfiction pieces that he had called Bigfoot Travels. Similarly, were pretty much as rough sketches. There is his biography. It's now underway by a guy that I spoke to for the book, a really, really great guy named Lance Richardson. And Lance told me that he expects to get more into this, considerably more into it than I do in this book. I think Peter, knowing that he had this Bigfoot fascination, gave me permission in a sense to kind of to dive into it. He had a couple of experiences, one of which he talks about in The Snow Leopard. And that was what he actually sort of half believed was a Yeti sighting in the Himalayas in the 1970s. And then he had a couple more experiences, one in Washington, one in Oregon, early aughts. And I'm really bad with dates. I apologize, but I don't have them right in front of me. But anyway, yeah. So he, the chapter basically opens with me going to the very spot, in the Pacific Northwest that Matt was sitting out of his very last Bigfoot expedition with Jeff Meldrum and Alexander Meldrum was a guy who kind of hit me off on that place, and I went where they had been just out of curiosity, just to see what they had seen and to just try to inhabit that space a little bit. So yeah, he was that surprised me quite a bit. And even some, there have been over the years several very serious kind of literary people that worked on Bigfoot, but not that many, but enough to kind of give me permission in a sense to go down the rabbit hole.
So he's one of the literary antecedents, and you go through some of those in the book. Let's talk about, we can't go through all of them because that's kind of like the bulk of the book, but can you kind of give our listeners a flavor of the kind of people you met as you traveled around the country and you know, some of the things that you learned as you went through it?
Yeah, sure. So I hung out with, mostly I hung out, I mean, so, well, how to say it? I guess, so I did three expeditions with Bigfoot groups, one in Kentucky, one in Massachusetts, and one in Northern California. And then I did kind of one of my own self-guided expeditions, which was in Washington State that I just mentioned. And I went to, you know, went to some conventions, or one convention in Texas, and Bigfoot festivals. Yeah. It would want kind of close by here in upstate New York. And I really, mostly who I interacted with was just sort of ordinary, like rank and file Bigfoots, you know, the guy, mostly guys, not all guys, but most of the guys who spend on weekends looking for Bigfoot. And that's who I wanted to meet. You know, I did talk to folks like Jeff Meldrum and Cliff Berkman and Bobo, you know, of James Bobo Saves of Finding Bigfoot. But I really explicitly did want to write about some of the better known folks. I do a little bit, but I mostly wanted to focus on people who really don't have any kind of desire for, or maybe they had desire for it, but have no national exposure, no real fluency in that world, and are really just kind of locally based Bigfooters, and also people who are relatively sane, you know, as I, what we might get into this, but there are some kind of very marginal elements in Bigfooting, not surprisingly. And I did get invited on one Bigfoot expedition early on with some people that I came to discover. Well, I don't want to say too much about it, but I'm glad I didn't go on that expedition. And that would have been a little too far afield for me to get into some of the weird elements of paranormal, supernatural stuff. I wanted to stay, might sound contradictory, but insofar as it was possible, I really wanted to stay in, you know, the factual, at least the conceivable.
You want to keep your Sasquatch grounded.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, your listeners may or may not know there are these kind of two poles of belief in Bigfoot. And, belief is, you know, really a silly word here. But, you know, there's what people, there's folks who call themselves quote unquote flesh and blooders who just believe that Bigfoot is, an undiscovered hominid species that they kind of roaming up undetected in the American wilds. And then there's what's called woo. And I get into this in the book. And the woo are just open to Bigfoot having a more paranormal or supernatural presence. And there's huge gray areas and shades of belief between those two poles, obviously. But those are the kind of two made schools of thought, for less of a better word. And I really wanted to stay as much as I could flesh and blood camp. And that's the majority of folks. And I didn't have a hard time doing that because that's really mostly what you encounter if you do expeditions with folks. And so that's really what I hung out with ordinary people, like, you know, looked at Walmart or, but also people who, one guy who worked on Wall Street, so, you know, stock traders and lawyers, and a lot of military people, a lot of cops, a lot of working kind of middle class will be people. Again, mostly guys, mostly white guys. That's really who I wanted to be to talk to. That's the vast majority of the books. So.
Okay. Now, you tell a story in the book about the ivory-billed woodpecker and David Sibley, who I knew earlier from before reading this, is the great bird expert. You know, everyone knows Sibley's Guide to Birds, right? And you make this really interesting connection about, again, the ivory-billed woodpecker and Bigfoot. So can you talk about that?
Yeah, I really wanted, well, two things. I wanted, I think I knew I wanted about midway through the book a break from Bigfoot. I thought readers would too. I did, you know, I did sort of three expeditions. The book couldn't be expedition, you know. And so I also wanted the kind of real world, real life corollary that I can, you know, use to compare to Bigfoot. I wanted to see how biologists or ornithologists vetted the either existence or extinction of a real species. And, so that's where Cebu came in, and I went to Arkansas to the Cache River there in kind of central east central Arkansas, which is where the ivory bill both was sort of last seen, and also where it's there have been reported sightings over the last decade. So, and I take that back. That wasn't where the last seen sighting, confirmed sighting, was in Louisiana. Sorry, 1944. But there have been a few reported sightings in this neck of the woods forever. And I just thought that would be like a very cool sort of sidebars to hunt for Bigfoot.
And so, how does the woodpecker connect to the Sasquatch? Like, what do they have in common?
Like, yeah, same, like very similar thing. There's a lot of people, a lot of grainy, kind of blurry images, photographs. People who get very hot under the collar about reported sightings and posting videos, and there are conferences, and there's like a whole economy that grew up around the ivory bill woodpecker in this part of Arkansas when the sighting. Came out, and so I talked to David, and I there are sort of quote unquote experts on Ivoryville. Also talked to Tim Gallagher at the Cornell Lab, who wrote a really wonderful book about the Ivoryville woodpecker. And so that's the only sort of direct, sort of semi direct connection, is that there's the cultures are some surprisingly similar.
Yeah, the birders. The birders and the Bigfooters.
Yeah, exactly. With one major exception, which was we absolutely know that Blackfoot existed. Never sizable populations, but considerable populations in the southern swamps of this country were exterminated in the early part of the 20th century by about the mid 20th century. They were.
Okay. You talk in the book also about, in between the expeditions, you also talk about Bigfoot and pop culture. So let's get into that for a little bit. You mentioned these before, but we have to talk about, Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin, the Patterson-Gimlin film. So refresh our listeners' memory if they don't know, like, who are these guys and how do they enter, the Bigfoot history?
Yeah, so they were, filmmakers is not quite the right word, but they made a film. They were kind of budding filmmakers, or Patterson was, and this is his friend, Bob Gimlin, too. Help kind of track and make a film. They wanted to capture Bigfoot on film. They thought it would be Roger thought it would be a good one to make the scheme. And they captured an image of Bigfoot walking across a stream, a kind of riverbank in Northern California called Bluff Creek in 1968. And it is, I think, the single-handed most famous and most refuted piece of Bigfoot evidence ever. I mean, even if people don't know it by name, they probably almost certainly have seen a snippet of that on YouTube at some point or somewhere, or have certainly seen that iconic profile of Bigfoot slapped on a beer can or a bumper sticker or whatever. I mean, it's just become that ubiquitous, some glancing profile of Bigfoot that we have sort of all of today. And it had a huge impact on the culture, happened to land right at the time when Bigfoot was sort of entering the cinemas of America in the late 60s, or 1970s. And Patterson originally planned this documentary, and it was ultimately packaged as a full-length documentary on, quote-unquote, documentary should be, it's where scare quotes there, but as a full-length documentary about Bigfoot in America. And it's highly contentious piece of people on both sides have tried to prove and disprove it. Despite what you think of it, and you might take one look and decide it's all bullshit, it's a really interesting document, an interesting snapshot of that period of American history.
Yeah, if you go on YouTube, I mean, it's like that film has been analyzed like the Zapruder film. It's like the Zapruder film of Bigfooting.
Yeah,
that's like these people who stabilize it. They look at this. They use technology to kind of spin it around to prove, and the arm swing, and they measure the gait and things like that. I mean, it's fascinating.
Yeah, the guys I hung out with, my Northern California expedition, I hung out with the guys called the Bluff Creek Project. Really, really nice, great guys. Finally allowed me to tag along and interfere with their project, which is to try to recreate the Patterson-Gimlin film. Same technology that was available in 1968 and same exact location. And and sort of using the same film techniques. And that was an awesome experience. I mean, it was just they aren't ideologues. They don't really have particularly strong feelings. They like, again, they sort of like the idea of Bigfoot, like me, but they're not particularly. I'm sort of lumping all the members of this group into sort of one monolithic definition, and that some of them would probably kind of roll their eyes at this. But the specific guys I hung out with, I didn't get the sense that they devout their beliefs in Bigfoot. They're into film, and they're into just into possibility. They wanted to see how the film was made and if it could possibly have been true. So
there's a good element of Civil War reenactors in those guys, right? Like, we're going to go back with the original stuff and see how close we can get to the actual moment.
Exactly. Yeah, I did think there's that Tony Morowitz book, Confederates in the Attic. I've never read that, but that,
yep,
just a great book. I did think of that while I was there, because we did do some filming, and I participated in about some shoot that they were doing. They kindly allowed me to do that, and there is some that element of nostalgia. I think is another thing at play in the allure of Bigfoot. Wow, and it really came out in sort of full force there.
Yeah. You mentioned the cinema, so a lot of our listeners will know about Harry and the Hendersons. That's the 1987 Bigfoot family comedy. I remember being a kid in the mid-70s. You reminded me of this book where Colonel Steve Austin, the $6 million man, had to fight Bigfoot, and Bigfoot was interdimensional in that one, in that incarnation. But none of these seem to have the impact that is a film you discuss, The Legend of Boggy Creek. So can you talk about The Legend of Boggy Creek and what that did for the Bigfoot image?
Yeah, and that's because the people my age, I don't know how old you are, but I'm 50. And so for me, my kind of foundational Bigfoot movie was Harry and the Hendersons. But the Bigfooters, in my experience, tend to be usually about a decade or even a decade and a half, got older than I am. That's obviously not everybody, but most folks tend to be a little bit older. And for that demographic, it's The Legend of Boggy Creek, which is a sort of cinema verite style pseudo-documentary on a Bigfoot-like swamp monster in southern Arkansas, actually not very far at all. It's crow flies from Cache River, where I was. And I use that, my time there, to kind of write about it a little bit. And just that era, again, of American cinema, American pop culture, and how Bigfoot manifested, not just on the screen, but like in history and writing and in the news and just in American imagination. There's an element, of course, of like silliness and disbelief and almost kind of schlocky, B-movie style stuff with a lot of Bigfoot. Some really almost all of them, fortunately. But Boggy Creek, I mean, it's a schlocky movie, but it definitely strove to be serious and terrifying. And I think to moviegoers in that 1970s it was. I think, we're looking at it, through our lens of the last half century, it doesn't thrill or terrify like it once did, but I think it was a pretty important film for a lot of people.
So another way people have learned about Bigfoot is by, you have Harry and the Hendersons, you have Boggy Creek, but if another one is, as you mentioned this before, is Finding Bigfoot. So the show Finding Bigfoot, it ran on Animal Planet, 9 seasons, 100 episodes. It was unbelievably popular. And people would watch it. They'd say like, oh, I guess we're not going to get him this week. Let's see what next week is. And even though every episode had all these common elements, you'd have Bobo on the side of the road. Was it this high? Was it this high?
Yeah,
you go to the meeting and everyone, hey, raise your hand if you saw Bigfoot, everyone, and then the interview, like every episode had almost the same structure. It was like The Fugitive or something, or Columbo. Yeah. Everyone was the same, but it was like wildly popular. So what do you think that show did for the average American's understanding of this phenomenon?
Probably not much, actually, because fortunately, it's funny because Bigfoot. Freud and Slim Bobo was with us
right
at Bluff Creek for less than, he didn't stay the night. He just kind of hung out for a while. But and he told me, I was surprised, but also not surprised to hear that he has some not very fond memories of that show and not fond feelings of what it did to his kind of reputation and the pigeonhole that they, basically forced him into over and over again. I mean, it's formula television. So I think he says something like that in my book. That might not be a direct quote, but something like that. It's
Yeah.
just they wanted to be what they wanted to be. It's, as you said, very formulaic, and it's just television. And television just does, no offense to TV, I love TV, but it just does not, reality TV does not hold up well with reality at all, you know. And it's just it comes across as less than serious. And and I think probably to the average man, the average television viewer, whatever, to find some shrug their shoulders. It's entertaining, something to do, before dinner or something. But I think Bigfooters, if you really ask them, like the sort of real diehards, probably don't love that show. I think they probably, I'd guess, I'm prepared to be wrong about this, but I'd guess that many would think it trivializes their beliefs, their own pursuits.
So speaking of those beliefs, let's go back earlier in the book. You talk about this idea of the null hypothesis and the differences between a science and a pseudoscience. And it seems to me like you want to do that early in the book. Let's have this conversation right now with the reader. So let's talk about what the null hypothesis is and how it keeps coming into play, it seems, with the Bigfooters you meet.
Yeah, so full admission is that I'm probably the wrong person to talk about null hypothesis. I'm not like a super science literate person, and I'm pretty honest about it in the book. And I think we're not a science literate culture at all. And I, you know, but I that section, I had several of my friends, I have a friend who was a chemist at a, at a pharmaceutical, and another was a kind of science writer. He was like, getting there with books. Like, yeah, it looks okay. That sounds okay. But in short, a null hypothesis is, so you come up in science, both in academic and laboratory science, you come up with a hypothesis, and then you come up with its opposite, contrary or null hypothesis. And then you attempt to disprove the null hypothesis, so you can then continue trying to disprove your hypo, trying to prove your hypothesis, such that you can then continue to work on the research that you want to work on. And if you can't disprove it, then the whole idea is complete. And this comes into Bigfooting just because, Bigfooters often, kind of begin scientifically, at least or to begin scientifically, the hypothesis, the null hypothesis, but really kind of wipes the hands of both, eventually, in my experience. Again, I don't want to talk about Bigfooters as a totally monolithic group, but science is really hard. Doing even such for scientists, like they get it wrong, the data sets are wrong. There's this guy at Columbia who's been in the news recently, who's done one of their, like, esteemed researchers there, who's done cancer research for years. Turns out his data research is, a lot of it, his data is completely fucked. Sorry, can you swear on this podcast? Okay. And so, it's just, science is not easy to do. And there's a way in which Bigfooters want to be, they want to be serious. They call themselves citizen scientists, but they're not really. I mean, if we be totally honest, I think a lot of them would admit that they're not following, kind of science by the book here. And a perfect example of that is this thing that gets passed around a lot by Bigfooters. I saw Jeff Elkman brought out again at this conference in Texas, where, supposedly the reason there's no good evidence, no physical evidence, to say nothing of photographic or video evidence, in an era where everyone has a state-of-the-art camera, video recorder in their pocket, but there's no real physical evidence, no Bigfoot body or bones or any of that stuff. It's that Bigfoot, supposedly big mammals, deteriorate in the wild really quickly. And Meldrum writes about that in his book, Sasquatch Legend Meets Science. And for just for your listeners who don't know, Jeff Meldrum is an anatomist at Idaho State University, at one of the very few sort of bad boy scientists who's thrown his lot in with Bigfooters. It used to be Grover Krantz, but he passed away, and Jeff Meldrum has kind of taken on that mantle. But Meldrum came up with this at some point and published it in school and trots it out at conferences. I talked to wildlife biologists from Montana to Maine for this. They all told me the same thing, that's complete bullshit. That big mammal bones, I talked to moose and elk biologists, I talked to grizzly and black bear biologists, and they all said, no, big mammal bones stick around for a really long time. They don't just wither up and die. They take a lot, sometimes years, to disappear and to be entirely sort of essentially compost it back into wilderness. And, you know, hunters come in with bear bones and bear skulls and elk skulls from all the time. They're really old from real remote locations. And so anyway, that's just like one of these ways that something gets passed around. And this happens all the time in sort of every sort of corner of pop culture. Things just get passed around as kind of truisms and they're not really investigated. And that's what's going on with Bigfoot. And, you know, I think they, and that's not, which is not to say Bigfooters don't do some valuable work. Whether they're doing actual science, I think is extremely debatable.
Yeah. The whole null hypothesis part reminded me of when people talk about UFOs, right? It's a very similar kind of thing, right? It reminded me of, what is that? The Fermi paradox.
Right.
Which is that if the universe is teeming with alien life, then where is everybody?
Yeah.
And
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, go ahead.
Well, and Bigfooters are saying sort of, you know, something similar, which is, it could be that Bigfoot doesn't exist, which is, of course, unfalsifiable. And it's a hard, it's hard to know sometimes how much people really believe what they say they believe. That's something I uncover again in this book. It's really hard to know how much to take people at their word. Sometimes we don't even know how much we really believe. We claim to believe in things that maybe we sort of don't, or we know what the right answer is. No, I don't believe, of course, I don't believe ghosts, but I had this experience when my grandma passed away, and that she died. There's something that psychologists call half-belief, which is the way in which our purported beliefs or unbeliefs in things don't align with our behavior. I talk a little bit about this in the book, and we all do this. You know, my wife and I are like sort of famous for make a declarative, you know, affirmation or declarative statement about something we hope will happen in the future, and look around and, oh, knock on wood, you better knock on wood. You know, you get up across the room, knock on a piece of wood just in case you upset the sort of psychic odds out there, you know? And so we all behave in ways that are, we all believe stuff that's not totally rational, that's maybe even completely irrational. And we do this in myriad ways all the time. For us do it. I do it, you do it, and it makes it really difficult. It makes it challenging sometimes to talk about belief in any sort of definitive way.
Yeah, you reminded me just now that in the 18th century, Samuel Johnson was asked about the existence of ghosts, and he said it's wonderful that all these thousands of years have gone by, and we still don't know. And he said about ghosts, all the evidence is against them, but all the belief is for them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like your book, right?
Yeah, and I definitely, as I said earlier, I think we need to be guided by reason and rationality. I don't think you really want to lose contact with a more enchanted view of the world. You know, you want to be open to mystery and possibility, because science doesn't explain it. Science and rationality leave us kind of cold at a certain point, you know? And there's got to be, I think, more in your life. I use this term very lightly, because I'm not a religious person at all. This book, in some ways, it's a kind of anti-religious book. But there is room, I think, for both reason and spirituality to kind of share the same sense. And I think I definitely didn't want to do in this book is be a huge buzzkill about things that really matter a lot to me.
Yeah. Well, you definitely get the sense as a reader that the people you were with didn't mind having you around, and they were happy to talk to you, and you had a good time. I mean, like, you know, at no point was I reading the book, and I thought, man, this sounds like a real, like you said, a real buzzkill. Like, it sounds like you had a great time, like, traveling around and learning about this.
Yeah, I did. It was a lot of fun. I was surprised. As I say, I think several times I was, like, very, very often quite happy to be there. I mean, I was also alarmed at certain points of things that I saw. I was a little shocked that people's willingness to just put me back burner thinking and just be open. there's what sort of various in mind being sort of open to possibility and open to mystery and completely abjure all your sort of critical faculties,
Right.
and so tipping into QAnon fabulous stuff, Stone Election, and so on. But yeah, for the most part, I really had a great time, and I was in these really miraculous landscapes and parts of the country, and in one just a couple hours near the Berkshires, which I that was one of my favorite expeditions. Just had a great time with those guys, and so yeah, it was I met a few very early on. I had some weird experiences with just getting kind of ghosted by people, or just people not showing up when they said where and when they said they were. But by and large, I had a really very happy time searching.
So we've kind of established that Bigfoot is this kind of connection to nature that people have lost. And maybe that's why he turns up on, you said, beer cans and T-shirts. And, I'm wearing my Bigfoot baseball cap right now as we speak. So he's kind of everywhere. But for the kind of like to sum up, I want to get your reaction to this, because this is something your book made me realize, was that the Bigfoot as a pop culture icon is amusing. People have like garden gnomes of Bigfoot giving a peace sign or like hold the American flag. Like, he's always like this kind of like chill monster, right? He sells beef jerky. But all of the eyewitness accounts, in air quotes, so to speak, they're all about how terrifying it is. And you even get the sense in some of your scenes, you're like, man, you're like, I wonder if like the little thing in John O'Connor's brain, like, wait a minute, man, if this thing actually comes out behind a tree, I don't know what I'm going to do. So what do you make of the fact that in pop culture, it's kind of like this fun-loving Harry and the Hendersons, but when you actually go out there and you're listening for tree knocks, everyone's like, listen, man, this thing is like, everyone that sees it says it was terrifying.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly a lot of congruity, a lot of overlap between those two things. Yeah, it's like, as you say, on the one hand, it's kind of a fun idea people are into possibilities, and just it's just like a cool icon. It says something good about American college, and that the idea that a 700 or 800 pound mammal could survive in the wild, like not even just in the wild, but some accounts in fucking not far from downtown Phoenix or whatever, so that I think people are attracted to that for obvious reasons. It's just it is, I think, with maybe the exception of ghosts, our biggest, most enduring kind of cryptid or some supernatural legend, just something that really suits the American psyche. And but also the other side of that, and a complimentary side, is that people like to be thrilled, people like to be entertained, and that's a lot about these expeditions. I'm like is that thrill of the terror of wild, the terror of what might look shadows.
Yeah.
But we don't have much opportunity to be terrified these days outside of the cinema. We don't have the opportunities to be challenged and to really come face to face with our mortality. So, sent on high, I suppose, but that's a different ball game altogether. But yeah, just, I think it's, There was kind of three main themes there are a bunch of themes that I encountered over and over, but three ones I really covered encountered the most were this kind of Bigfoot as part of this legend of a war that just handed down centuries, and it's just been part of the American experience almost from the very beginning, but especially in the last century. And then the second one is just our problems, are very real vision and perception problems, problems with memory, cognitive biases that just lead us in directions that lead us where we want to be led, essentially. And then there's, again, I've talked about already, but just our kind of, we're more sober instruction, which is very real and it's something that we, I think, don't want to feel too torn up about all the time. On that, we want to believe that there's something out
there. Yeah, something out there for other people to find, maybe.
Yeah.
if it is that scary. So thank you so much. I want to tell our listeners, The Secret History of Bigfoot, Field Notes on a North American Monster, is published by Sourcebooks. It's available anywhere books are sold. John O'Connor, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be here.